You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, it's the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. On today's program, we're proud to present an encore broadcast of our recent interview with recently freed longtime political prisoner Leonard Peltier. Later in the show, we present an encore of the latest headlines from Gaza from the Electronic Intifada podcast. All this straight ahead on the best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm here with our senior producer, Miguel Gavilan Molina, and we are honored, absolutely honored, to be joined by Native American leader, free in the air now, Leonard Peltier. Leonard Peltier, welcome to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we're happy to have you. And how about if we start here? What are the things that you missed most when you're inside? And was your painting a way of bridging that gap?
Well, for somebody like me, that was the companionship of a woman. I missed that. And still, that was one of my most missed things. And of course, freedom, would have been nice to experience a little freedom in 49 years. That was probably the second most thought about wish for freedom and to continue the battle for saving Native people from extermination. Those were probably the most main things that I experienced anyway.
Can I ask you, what do you think, given the fact that the United States government has the most powerful army in the world, and Native Americans don't have those kind of weapons, why is the U.S., why are white people in the U.S. still afraid of Native Americans? What are they afraid of?
Well, they're afraid of learning the truth of what was really done to us, how we were treated, how our women was stolen at young ages and tortured and prostituted, and our children as children. Every country was stolen. And they fled an oppressive government over from Europe, and they get to see there's a chance at freedom, which some of them took, and some of them did try to develop a free state and a free society, and they studied Native American culture. I had a chance to go with a powerful belief in political ideology, and in my lifetime it was before Nixon. Nixon tried everything he could, and now we see we're back in the same arena. We see we're still in danger right now, and that's what's happening.
You write in the spectacular book of your paintings, Leonard Peltier, Art Behind Bars, you write, "I have always loved painting my people or cultural subject scenes. I have always believed that we have a very unique culture, and that's true of all of our tribes, from the south to the north." Could you spend a few minutes describing that uniqueness? What is it that you're looking for? What is that special thing when you're painting indigenous communities and the life of that community?
Well, if you study the real history of indigenous culture and societies over here, we had a very advanced society, more so than Europe. We had an agricultural system that was way advanced compared to Europe. And everything that you get on your table today, vegetables and stuff like this, they didn't have over there. We had unique methods of bringing in irrigation and stuff like this here. We had a democratic society. I mean, there was some, you know, some a little bit off and but everything, but the majority of the native cultures practice very advanced societies. We had the best health system, that's for sure. Nobody here was sick. We have diseases over here. Over there in Europe, they had one black plague that came in, and it was 150 million people were affected. That's their own history now. There ain't no history we made up. That's in their history books. So we didn't have that over here. It's true. Nobody was sick here. Everything that we got a cold, we got some kind of disease, or whatever, got sick for something, we knew what food to take. And we had a very healthy society. We treated our women with dignity. We didn't beat our women. No. You beat your woman. The societies that protected the camps came and gave you one warning. One warning. You do that again, we'll take care of you. We built monuments over here. Monuments that are still alive. I'm talking about this continent now, this whole continent. So we had a pretty advanced society over here. And those are the things that was taken away from us and hidden. They try to make false statements about us that we were all a bunch of savages and cannibals and we were a very advanced society over there. We also were in the copper and the bronze society. We already had, we had stuff. They're finding all kinds of things that some tribe had that material. So we were moving up in that area also, but that's the only thing that they had advantage over us. They had a better weapon, in other words. And no, this is what we're teaching our kids. This is what we're telling our kids. We were not savages.
Could you say, would you say, I'm looking at this extraordinary painting you did called Hawkman. You did it in 2007. Actually, it's Hawkman 2. And I believe it's a self-portrait. What do you have in common with the hawk?
Well, one of my heroes was called Crazy Horse. They are building a monument of him right now. He's been doing it for over 100 years in South Dakota. Crazy Horse Monument. It's going to be the biggest monument in the world. His history in the native world was phenomenal. He was a good person, a good man, and one of the things that he took the prize from a Crow Scout was a hawk designed on his head, and he took that, and so they started calling him Hawkman. So the people gave him that name, Hawkman, the Kota people. And so that's why I painted those pictures. They want, some guys want me to paint some portraits and stuff, so I painted them on about Hawkman.
Let me, in one moment, my brother Miguel Gavala Molina wants to join in, but I do want to ask you this question and sort of turning the conversation, if you will, in the overt politics. What do you suppose the creation of the American Indian movement, what did that mean to Native Americans in this country? And what kind of signal do you suppose that sent to the powers that be, to white America? How do you think the indigenous communities coming together, organizing in this modern age for the American Indian movement, what did that mean in the middle of all of this?
Well, first of all, the American Indian movement was perhaps one of the fastest growing Indian Native organizations in America on this continent. We also worked at that all the way down into Mexico and all the way down Central America. We had Native, there's a lot of Native people, indigenous people in those continents. We had them joining us. We had Canada, We were one of the fastest growing Native organizations in history. And the Native people appreciated how we stood up before them. Let me explain this first of all. The American Indian Movement policy is we cannot go into a tribe and dictate our policy. Our policy was to reestablish our religion, our culture, everything that was taken away from us illegally by force, by torture. So we went in and advocated that stuff. But we, when we were invited by the traditionalists of any nation, tribal nation, we went in as protectors. We did not go in there to dictate anything to them. This is our policy, and it still stands today as far as I'm concerned. And we went in and we fought for the people. We took an oath to defend them with our lives and freedom. And that's what I did. And I know that all the other Native warriors of the American Indian Movement did the same thing. And that's who we were. But to the government, we became a threat to them because there was such an abundance of Native tribes that was coming in to join us, standing with us. Members of those tribes that were afraid to step forward, who didn't have the leadership quality to step forward to lead them. So when we came along, they totally joined us as fast as they could. And that's why we became a threat to the United States of America.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we're speaking with an indigenous leader, Leonard Peltier, who is out in the free air now, and we're having the opportunity, the wonderful opportunity to talk to him on Flashpoints. Leonard, there's somebody here who is really anxious to say hello and has a few questions. This is Miguel Gavilan Molina. He's a senior producer on our show.
It's good to hear your voice, Leonard, and thank you for taking the time. First of all, the Hawk, I'm Yaqui Tohono O'odham from the Arizona Sonora Desert, and my name was given as Gavilan, which is in Spanish. In English, is Hawk. So it's something that I embraced all my life. When I saw that painting that you did with the Hawk, it just really moved me, because it's my spirit that calls me. That said, Leonard, we have been advocating for your freedom and release on my own for 45 years. I can't tell you how many, you know, vigils, marches, protests in front of federal buildings, you know, decade after decade, gathering the drum, prayer, chanting, and even the freedom song that has been dedicated to you. It has been a spiritual, for me, a spiritual like movement inside my being. And that said, what I see right now happening, Leonard, is that there's a spiritual cultural war against the indigenous peoples of this country and, for that matter, the continent. And one thing that I've heard by different voices of AIM has always come to me and has been said that, you know, the Indian wars have never ended. This government is still out to, you know, take the reservations, the extraction, you know, taking water, taking minerals, all of that. It's a constant thing. In that context, this spiritual war, how are the Indian nations responding to it? Because this war that has been launched by the White House is what I call the evangelicals, the national supremacists, or some people call them the evangelicals. How do you see we as Native, as indigenous nations, pushing back against this spiritual cultural attack against our cultures and ways of life?
Well, first of all, let me say this. We have never stopped fighting. We'll never get the opportunity to stop because the threat that happened for over 500 years has to seize, it seems to arise every so often. And it's starting again. But we are a very, very popular race. People in Europe are very, very fond of it. And here in America, we got, I think the last survey that I seen was done by USA Today on people, communities that support minority groups. So, yes, we are under threat again. They're talking about our treaties being too old and they should be abolished. If our treaties are abolished, we are abolished. That means we don't exist no more. And if you look in history, you will see in the 50s, they were calling us the vanishing American Indian. We don't know what happened. Well, we knew what happened. We knew what was going on. And we have never given up and we won't give up. We will not stop fighting. Our children are going to fight behind us. There's no doubt about it. Our grandchildren. There's no doubt about it. It's sad that I have to leave this world. Today I'm in this condition because I thought it was over. I thought we didn't have to worry no more. But it's still alive and it's going to be a dangerous part of our existence. And we have to unite. We got to unite like we never did before. And we just have to. We have to. If we're to survive. Because these people that are doing this are evil mother that want to exterminate us. We will not let them do it. They have no rights. Who gave them this right? Their God? What kind of God is that? I thought we're all made by the same God. Well, these are the people that are talking about our treaties are so old, they should be abolished. Talking about that now, 2025. Well, if they're abolished, we're abolished. Now we have no rights as a sovereign nation of people.
Well, they are going to attempt to abolish it, but it's not going to happen, Leonard. There's just too many of us.
No, because we need to unite. We've got to unite with everybody. We got to stand up together and tell, just like Canada said, never going to happen. Well, we got to say the same goddamn thing. It's never going to happen. That's how many armies you bring out, how many guns you bring out. We don't give a f-. We're going to stand up against you. That's all I got to tell you. You got to pay attention to that. We have some of the best warriors in the American Army coming out of there. And they're not all of them going to be fighting against us. Some of them are going to be standing with us, just like my generation. I was in the military. I got military training. Dennis did. People like that. They can't come to us and tell us you have to accept termination.
Exactly. It's not going to happen. And I've seen in the last four decades, Leonard, the youth are taking up, are taking up the mantle. They are there. They're ready. One of the things that I was really moved by, and that's that there's a potential battle here in California on Alcatraz, the rock Alcatraz Island. You know, every year, the four directions, all nations come together, and we've been gathering there for the last 35 years to do the sunrise ceremony to mourn for those that have lost to the injustice of this government and its colonial mindset. But also, recently, in the last 2-3 months, there's been a lot of talk coming in from the White House and the fascist there, the dictator. Yes, that they want to turn. Oh, absolutely, Leonard, and they are. That they want to turn that rock, which has become a sacred gathering for the last, 35 to 46 years, local California Indians and others have gathered there. Well, now they're talking about turning that place back into a penitentiary, a place of isolation, loneliness, suffering, torture, and even death. But, the nations, the four directions are coming together, and there's this unbelievable swelling of youth that are standing proud. And there's a lot of talk that the rock might symbolize where this, spiritual cultural war that's been launched against, you know, all nations in this country, you know, to in a sense, you know, put us down. But that rock is solid. It rises from the bottom of the ocean into the sky, and we're getting ready, and there's potential, you know, there's potential, you know, threats or concerns, but the drum beats and the people gather, and it's to see the youth, you know, and the energy, and they're, you know, they're ready to go into the future to preserve what has been done in the past. But the whole spiritual liberation of mind, body, and soul, you know, that I have learned, Leonard, and you know, you have been not only to me but to others an inspiration, and that is that you've taken art in such a way that has kept the dream of hope alive. And like an eternal flame, the power of art and meditation and prayer is something that we've all have learned from you. I just want to give you thanks for that. And again, we're getting ready this week to gather and go to the rock to do our ceremonies and the sunrise ceremonies that we do every year. And every year we make offerings, every year prayers for your freedom. And now you are free. And that freedom, you're back home where the buffalo roam. Thank you, Leonard, for taking, you know, some time to let me, you know, share this with you.
In closing, I would like to say this. Well, again, we can't, we've got to unite. We've got to. And from watching and listening to some of the younger people, they're more, as they call us, militants and stuff than I believe our generation was. And so there's going to be a battle there that's going to be, even if we lose it, it's going to be a sore eye on the American government, and it's going to hurt them bad if they go in there and kill off any large numbers of Native people. It's not going to be a walk in the park for them, and we're not going to let it.
Speaking, Leonard, if I could just grab you before we let you go, because I know you have to go, but I want to just ask you this question. In 2025, the chant we hear a lot is "Free, Free Palestine." What does that mean to you as an indigenous leader? How do you hear "Free, Free Palestine"?
Well, I scream that we got to free them, because they're doing the same goddamn thing they did to us. Remember that, all those massacres that took place here in America. There's dozens and dozens of them. They attacked villages that were unarmed and killed women, children, babies, unborn babies. They're doing the same goddamn thing over there in Gaza, Palestine, and. I don't understand why the people, there's a lot of people I know standing up, but why aren't we in an outrage? What happened to the American fucking people? What are they just ignoring what's happening there? We got to make them step up with us and say, no, stop that massacre and stop it now. We got to do this. And, no, I've been saying since identifying Palestine with Native American history, and that's why we can never let it go silent. And they keep saying the past is the past. Both, you're just doing it in a different land right now. This is the same thing you did here, and we got to stand up for them. I have for what, 60 years or so. Because I identified with what they're doing over there. Because our history had the same goddamn thing done to them. And we got to stop it. We got to stop it somehow. You know, we got a midterm election coming. We have to win this by such a wide margin that it'll go down in history. It'll go down. We got to make sure that. It's so goddamn large, it'd be shocking to them. We've got to get rid of those stuff. They got to go. We've got to deport their asses. Where, I don't know.
Oh, sorry for interrupting you. I don't know if you had, if you want to finish your final remarks, but that's powerful. We're inspired as we listen to you, Elena Peltier.
I'm not advocating violence. I want people to understand that, because I'm not totally free here. I'm basically on house arrest, but it's better than a cell. Every time I go even to the post office, I got to ask permission. I got to let my, not ask permission, but I got to let notify them that this is where I'm going. I'm going shopping or whatever. I got to notify them. And it's starting to get a little bit easier now, because now they know I'm not into drugs and alcohol or weapons. There ain't no weapons in my house. There's no alcohol in my house. There's not no drugs. And I'm not a pervert, so you don't have to worry about that. And I'm not saying what's saying. I still love women. Still looking for girlfriends. But I'm not a perv. So, I want you to all know that, again, I have to protect myself. I cannot advance or advise violence. I can't do that. Again, you'll put me right back in a cell, and I will, for boot reasons, you can't take me back to prison on what I got commutation for, and that was a sentence. And the sentence that they imposed on me, illegally on my dad.
In spite of all those restrictions, Leonard, in spite of all those restrictions, you sound absolutely free to us. And I'm gonna be a freer person walking out of the studio than when I walked in.
Yeah. Well, I feel freer, of course. I got my cousins ready to come down to visit me. I hadn't seen in 50 years. That's a hell of a feeling and everything, just to see them and stuff like that. I mean, I didn't get that chance in prison, so I got some freedom here, some of it, and I'm grateful for it. But it's because of the people that stood behind me worldwide, the people that got in the streets, the people that, and I know who a lot of them people were. They were constantly writing me letters, sending me a little bit of commissary money and stuff like this here. Those are the people that I am very, very grateful to. They were in the marches. They did everything they could. You got a lot of people now saying, oh, I did this, I did that. Now, I don't say it. I just look at them like, yeah, sure. But I'm glad of the freedom I got now. And I hope to live to be 100.
Well, we're delighted you're out of the cage. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for wanting me to speak to you. I hope I made sense to you. And
absolutely.
I hope I didn't sound like an asshole.
Not at all.
The linguistics are an important part of this, and you need the full range of language to express your experience, and we welcome you all the way.
I believe this. Anybody that comes out of prison after spending those type of years and then say, oh, I want to get America, I appreciate America, to me that's guilty. I come out of there saying what I believe. These motherfuckers illegally sent me to prison, made me serve all that time illegally, and how would I be so America the great? Damn. Well, that's the way I say it.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much for your interest in doing the show, and I know you guys have done a lot of shows in the past, and I'm very grateful, and I want to say hello to and thank you to all the listeners, and hopefully I'd like to be able to meet all of
you. Love to have you. You're always welcome.
All right.
Thank you so much, Leonard. And as we say out here in California, aho.
There's a difference between you and me.
Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Up next on the program, an encore broadcast of the latest headlines on Gaza from the Electronic Intifada. Listen to this.
This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 734 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Early Thursday morning, as news of a possible end to the slaughter began to circulate, journalist Salah al-Jafarawi and his colleagues, along with recording their own updates, informed people by walking in the streets and shouting that there was an end to the war and a hopeful truce. Reporter Anas Ayad captured this clip. Just a few hours ago, Salah al-Jafarawi filmed celebrations in the streets. Members of Gaza's heroic civil defense, he says, share in the joy of the news of a ceasefire. Here is that clip.
في شمال قطاع غزة الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله ربنا أكرمنا وشوفنا هذه مشاهد الحمد لله
أرواحنا من أجل الله
أرواحنا من أجل الله
عرقنا من أجل الله
عرقنا من أجل الله
عملنا من أجل الله
عملنا من أجل الله.
Palestinians on the ground in Gaza City say that since the ceasefire talks in Egypt began earlier this week, Israel only continued to escalate its attacks. The Gaza government media office stated on Wednesday that in the 4 days since the announcement of a potential truce, Israel carried out 271 separate attacks, killing approximately 126 people, 80 of whom were killed in Gaza City. Our longtime contributor Mohammed Assad uploaded images after the Israeli army destroyed his home earlier this week on October 7th in Gaza City, forcing his family to seek shelter once again. His home was damaged in previous attacks, and his family worked to clean it up and repair it. But this week it was completely razed to the ground. Quote, "Our dreams turned into a mirage," he said. Earlier in the week, the media office released updated statistics on the 2 years of genocide, including figures on the destruction of homes, livelihood, health, and infrastructure across Gaza. Among the data set was an estimate that Israel has dropped more than 200,000 tons of explosives on Gaza since October 2023. More than 835 mosques were completely destroyed, the media office added, and at least 180 others were damaged, while 3 churches were damaged in bombings. More than half of all Gaza's 60 cemeteries have been targeted as well, 14 of which have been completely destroyed and 18 partially destroyed. The media office estimates that nearly 80,000 Palestinians have been killed or are still missing since the beginning of the genocide, 67,000 of whom were brought to hospitals and recorded as killed by the health ministry. Nearly 10,000 are missing and still buried under the rubble, and approximately 20,000 children have been killed. Among the dead are 1,015 infants under a year old. 460 Palestinians have died from starvation, and nearly 170,000 have been injured, including 19,000 who will need long-term rehabilitation. 4,800 people have had their limbs amputated, nearly a fifth of them children. Israeli armored vehicles packed with explosives have continued to destroy buildings and entire city blocks around Gaza City, particularly in the Sabra neighborhood. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reported on Wednesday that, quote, Israeli forces are scaling up attacks aimed at the systematic destruction of the city's remaining infrastructure, flattening what is left of residential buildings, public facilities, and entire neighborhoods. The army is reportedly using remote-controlled explosive robots alongside air attacks and heavy artillery to demolish densely built areas, Mahmoud added. Fighter jets have targeted wide boulevards and high-rise blocks in the city center, leaving large sections of Gaza City reduced to rubble. Despite talk of a potential agreement, many in Gaza believe the Israeli military is rushing to complete the destruction before any truce takes effect. On the ground, people describe what feels like the final stage of destruction, an effort to render Gaza uninhabitable by erasing all means of life, he said. On October 3rd, reporter Hamza Kareka spoke to a grandmother who survived an Israeli attack on tent shelters at the Gaza port. Sitting on the floor next to a metal bed with no mattress where 2 small children lay unconscious, she asks, quote, what did children do to deserve this? 3 children and their mother, who is my daughter, and my sister, over 15 people were killed in this strike. What did they do? She says that they were displaced from Jabalia in northern Gaza, and the Israeli army targeted their tent. Palestinian civil defense workers in Gaza say that the situation in the north of Gaza is apocalyptic, especially following last week's closure by Israel of the main north-south road in and out of Gaza City and the rest of the northern governorates. Civil Defense Ambulance Services worker Mohammed Tamous was filmed by journalist Mohammed Abu Luay on October 5th. Tamous says that massacres, bombings, and detonations are happening around the clock with no let-up. Quote, entire landmarks and blocks have been erased and have fallen on top of residents' heads. Entire families are erased from the civil registry. In northern Gaza, life has become almost non-existent. There is no electricity, water, food, or drink, or anything suitable for life. The situation here is very difficult, very catastrophic, he said. On October 7th, marking 2 years of Israel's genocide in Gaza, Palestinian civil defense spokesperson Mahmoud Bassal described what 24 months of relentless assault has taken from Palestinians, with the whole world watching. He said that along with the enormous death toll, 2,700 families have been completely erased from the registry, and 6,000 people are now the sole survivors of their entire families. More than 90% of all homes in Gaza, Bassal says, have been destroyed in Israel's 2-year assault. More than 80% of Gaza itself is under the control of the Israeli occupation. He says, quote, 2 years of war, and we still say to the whole world, we continue to repeat to the world that we are a people who deserve to live, and that our people deserve to live like any other people in the world, and that they have the right to be safe and at peace without any war or murder. Also on Tuesday, Al Jazeera's Hind Khoudari reported that a Palestinian child was shot in the head in eastern Gaza, and six Palestinians were killed in separate attacks in the southern city of Khan Yunis. She said, quote, "This shows that despite everything going on in the negotiations over the U.S. proposed ceasefire deal, Palestinians are still being killed throughout the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military's explosive robots continue destroying residential neighborhoods where Palestinians know that even if this war is brought to an end, they won't find anything to go back to." Maha Husseini, a journalist, human rights worker, and researcher in Gaza with the Euromed Human Rights Monitor, recorded this video for the United Nations Human Rights Council meeting earlier this week.
"Mr. President, I speak to you from my last refuge after I was forcibly expelled from my home in Gaza City under relentless Israeli bombardment. Though I don't know if by the time you hear these words, I will still be alive or buried under a rubble. Gaza is under unprecedented Israeli attacks, and I have been forcibly displaced with my colleagues at Euromed Human Rights Monitor several times now. I meant to present this statement as a human rights defender, to document and to advocate, but today I can no longer count the Israeli crimes I witness because they surround me in every breath and every hour. It's a shame that I had to tear up my business card at some point during this genocide to avoid being killed or detained by the Israeli military. We demand, not plead, we demand immediate protection for those documenting genocide in Gaza. We demand unhindered access for international investigators, and we demand that the perpetrators are brought to justice. Every silence from you, representatives of states and civil society at this council, is another strike of the hammer driving the coffin of the international law."
Maha Husseini of Euromed Human Rights Monitor. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported on Tuesday that Israel's destruction of the health system over the last 2 years is complete and deliberate. Quote, "Over the course of 730 days, the health sector has been subjected to devastating and lethal attacks that have ravaged the very fabric of its services and infrastructure," the health ministry stated. The ministry added, quote, "These crimes have earned the description health genocide due to the catastrophic indicators that have ravaged the health and humanitarian landscape in the Gaza Strip. Observers and decision makers in international health and humanitarian institutions are concerned about the success of emergency responses that maintain a minimum level of service. Hospitals have been transformed into concrete structures as a result of direct and indirect military strikes, completely emptied of the components of diagnostic and therapeutic care. More than 1,700 medical personnel have been killed, and 362 are still detained in Israeli torture camps, where they are being deprived of basic human rights. 25 hospitals out of 38 are completely out of service, leaving only 13 still partially operating under difficult conditions. Israel has also destroyed 103 primary healthcare facilities. 55% of all medicines are currently out of stock, 2/3 of all medical supplies are out of stock, and nearly 70% of laboratory supplies are out of stock," the ministry adds. James Elder, the spokesperson for the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, reported from Gaza on the prevention by the Israeli army of newborn incubators earlier this week, deliberately denying the most fragile babies basic machinery to keep them alive.
"All missions in Gaza are life-saving, and maybe this one particularly so, heading north right now into Gaza City to a hospital under evacuation order to get incubators out and to other hospitals where they are so desperately in need. Incubators, oxygen, ventilators." Here we go again, fifth time seeking approval to save children's lives. Fifth time.
That was from UNICEF. Last week, we reported on the Global Samud Flotilla, the 44 boats with nearly 500 humanitarian aid activists that attempted to break Israel's siege on Gaza. All of the boats were eventually hijacked and seized by Israeli forces, but the last boat, the Marinette, evaded Israeli capture until Friday, October 3rd. Right before it was hijacked, a Marinette passenger delivered this final message to Palestinians in Gaza.
From the sea to Gaza, we will not forget you. We will not let you to be forgotten. This is the voice of humanity. No one can stop the voice of humanity. Free, free Palestine!
After seizing all of the boats and unlawfully towing them out of international waters into the Ashdod port, Israeli forces detained all of the activists in Ashdod before transferring them to the notorious Ketziot prison in the Nakab Desert. In Ashdod, Israel's extremist national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, taunted and screamed at the flotilla activists, calling them terrorists. After her release, a Turkish activist described the abusive treatment that they experienced at the hands of Israeli guards. She says, quote, "We protested Ben-Gvir very well. I said, 'Shut your big mouth, you genocidal filth.'" She goes on to describe the harsh conditions inside the prison and says that there was writing on the wall in dried blood, words written by Palestinian women who had been imprisoned there before. The detained activists were told to drink water from the toilets. 22-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, who was a participant on the flotilla, was singled out for abuse, according to eyewitnesses. She was physically assaulted, and Israeli soldiers attached an Israeli flag to her back and tied her hands. Italian journalist Lorenzo Agostino described her treatment.
Greta Thunberg, a brave woman who is only 22 years old, she was humiliated and wrapped in an Israeli flag and exhibited like a trophy. I had the feeling of being in a really barbaric place, and I really hope that this barbarism might be over soon. First, we were kidnapped in international waters. Then they took us to land, and once on land, they behaved like a terrorist group. People were kicked. We were left without fresh water for over 2 days. Overall, they took every opportunity to humiliate any of us. We were treated like terrorists because we thought we were terrorists. So I was unlucky enough to get out just while Ben-Gvir was coming. And so the police used very, very tight handcuff on us that stopped our circulation. They blindfolded us and they put us in a van with barely any clothes and with very, very low temperature. So higher conditioning that was like freezing. And they kept her there for like probably 3 hours.
After she was released, Greta Thunberg said this at a press conference.
No, wait, no, not heroes. No, no, we are doing the bare minimum. What we are doing is not in any way. No one has to come to the rescue of Palestinian people.
Shifa Abdi, a Finnish Somali activist, told reporters after she was released from Israeli detention that the most shocking thing about the prison wasn't the abuse they faced, but the place itself. She says, quote, "When we arrived at the prison, there was a picture on the wall showing the destruction of Gaza, all the houses in ruins, and Palestinians in Gaza trying to find their families or their belongings. And on that picture, it says in Arabic, Gaza al-Jadida, or New Gaza. They are proud of it. What they have done to Gaza is a source of pride for them. Beneath it was a large dried blood stain. We had to anxiously think about what had been done to the Palestinians here. Every cell was filled with the names of Palestinian men. We found a piece of cloth we tried to clean with because no one cleaned anything there. and on it there was an embroidered name, Abu Allah. That's how we found out the names of the Palestinian prisoners. Every night I was anxiously thinking, where had these men been taken? What had been done to them? Where is Abu Allah? I'm in Helsinki now, but where is Abu Allah? Allah's father, where is he? What have they done to him? Activist Shifa Abdi speaking in Helsinki earlier this week. Another flotilla of three boats named after the Gaza sunbirds, Alaa al-Najjar and Anas al-Sharif, set off towards Gaza from southern Europe as the global Samud flotilla was being hijacked last week. All three boats were intercepted and hijacked by Israeli forces early in the morning on October 8th. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Underdog Palestine Will Prevail by Asim al-Nabi, writing from Gaza. He writes, quote, in the brutal arena of history, Palestine has never been a heavy hitter. Israel possesses the warplanes, the tanks, the surveillance networks, and the unwavering backing of global superpowers. The battlefield is tilted, the referee biased, and yet somehow Palestinians are still here, demanding our rights and calling for our freedom, not because we overpower, but because we endure. For colonized people like us, victory was never going to be a knockout punch. We never dreamed of winning in one decisive blow. The imbalance of power is too immense for such fantasies. But if history teaches anything, it's that those who survive each round, bleeding but upright, sustained by clarity and collective purpose, are often the ones who endure until the final bell. What's happening now is more than political. It's epistemic. It's a war of narratives deciding who gets to define reality, whose suffering counts, whose voices are amplified. For decades, Israel dominated the narrative. It set the parameters of discussion and held influence over much of the global media coverage. While that still holds true with the mainstream corporate media in the West today, young Gazans with no electricity and shattered phones are speaking truths that millions are now hearing. Our narrative is breaking through, unfiltered, raw, undeniable. And that is one of the most decisive shifts of all. In the long game of history, narrative matters. Israel is rapidly losing the struggle for moral and political legitimacy. As global perceptions shift and sympathy grows for the Palestinian liberation struggle, the role of memory becomes even more vital. Children raised on truth and dignity do not forget. They carry stories like weapons, like seeds. And when the time comes, they use them to rebuild, to teach, to hold the world accountable. Gaza has long been a synonym for suffering, besieged, bombed, and starved. We have endured nearly two decades of blockade, multiple military aggressions, and for the past 2 years, a genocidal war, the most devastating in our lifetime. Hundreds of thousands displaced, entire neighborhoods wiped off the map, families incinerated in their sleep. And yet, amid all of this, we continue to live, to resist, to speak, to demand our rights, to insist on our freedom. Ultimately, Israel's aim is to break the will of Palestinians and make us believe that resistance is worse than futile, that history has abandoned us, that the world has turned its back on us for good. That is the true purpose of the siege and the bombs and the orchestrated hunger, not just to kill bodies, but to kill the generational chain of the Palestinian narrative of dispossession, return, and liberation. And yet the truth survives, and with it, so do we. Israel's current leadership speaks of total victory and finishing the job. We don't aspire to the brute power of our occupiers. We aspire to be steadfast, and there is no algorithm, satellite, or bomb that can measure the power of a people who have decided not to die. Our victory will not come because we are stronger, but because we are more rooted, because we love this land more than anything else, because we know the face of this land like we know the faces of our children, because we have accepted the high price of freedom, and we pay it in grief, in bread shared between tents, in lullabies sung in the streets. We are not waiting for a final judgment from the World Court or a decisive vote at the UN. These are milestones, not destinations. What we are waiting for is the day when the injustice ends, criminals are held accountable, and the world finally recognizes the Palestinians' right of return and right to exercise self-determination throughout our historic homeland. We don't just fight to survive. We fight to remember, to rebuild, to belong. And we know that justice, though delayed, will not be denied forever. When will that day come? Maybe sooner than we think. After 2 years of unrelenting bloodshed in Gaza, the only dignified response is respect for our sacrifice rather than any attempt to claim credit for our victory. It must also be responded to with sustained, unwavering pressure on governments to halt the killing. The priority now is to end the slaughter and save Gaza and those who remain. Everything else will follow. Those are excerpts from Underdog Palestine Will Prevail by Asim An-Nabi on electronicintifada.net. Asim is the spokesperson for Gaza Municipality and an engineer and PhD researcher currently based in Gaza City. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. Al Jazeera's journalist Noor Abu Rukba filmed herself with a group of kids on October 4th, and she asked why they are happy. "We want an end to the war," they answer. She then asked them where they want to go, and they say they want to go back to their homes and play with their friends. And our contributor Asim An-Nabi, from whose story I just read an excerpt, posted this photo of a tree in East Gaza City on October 3rd. He says, quote, "This is the Sidra tree. Legend says it's 1,000 years old, Asim writes. Some believe it's a blessed tree, while others believe it grew over the grave of a saint. Palestinians in Gaza say that people have been unable to uproot it over the past centuries and that its roots extend dozens of meters underground. This tree sits at the intersection overlooking the Sayyid Hashim Mosque, where the tomb of the Prophet's grandfather, peace and blessings be upon him, is located to the south. If you walk a little east of the tree, you'll reach the Al-Hakimaya neighborhood, where I've lived for half my life. I've never found a neighborhood like it on earth. I passed by the tree today, and memories of a city of roots destroyed by the machine of killing and destruction came flooding back. However, the Gaza tree, impervious to uprooting, spoke volumes that tongues cannot express. This land remains rooted and eternal and will never die." And finally, reporter Saleh Al-Jafarawi captured this clip of the moment he came home and found his cat waiting for him at the door on October 6th. "I missed you," he said to his cat. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza.
You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
Does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.